Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. We're delighted to welcome Barneveld School District students. Would they please stand? Thank you. You may be seated. And we have Monticello High School students. Would they stand? Thank you for coming, and you may be seated. The students are here with a program that the Supreme Court sponsors along with the State Bar of Wisconsin. Under this program, high school students are invited to attend a court oral argument. If they agree to come, they're given briefs in the case that they will hear, and they may engage in activities related to the case. The other part of the program is that after the second case, they will meet with the justice, and the justice will discuss the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of the case. Everyone is welcome to join the students with the justice at about noon. If anyone is not familiar with the facts and legal issue in this case, we have a summary of the case that the marshal would be happy to give you. So raise your hand if you want a summary. Right. No one on the court is allowed to raise his or her hand in response to that question. Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far right is an empty chair, and usually Justice Patience Rogensack sits there, but she will not be participating. Next to that chair is Justice Pat Crooks. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice, and I will meet with the students at noon today. To my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her left is Justice Dave Prosser, and on the far left is Justice Lewis Butler. The other remark I would like to make is that at 11 o'clock, there will be a fire alarm. Which is a fire alarm noise that will be very annoying, but it is not a fire alarm unless they happen to coincide today, which I don't think they will necessarily. But so if you hear it, just stay seated, please. I'll now call our first case for today, 04AP1550, Stoughton Trailers, Inc. versus Lurk and Douglas Green. I'll give you the rundown. Mrs. Brooks?
Yes.
Brooks will argue 18 minutes for Stoughton Trailers. Ms. Lindner will argue 7 minutes for the Amicus Wisconsin Manufacturers. Mr. Carlson, John Carlson, is going to argue for Douglas Scott Green for 18 minutes. And Mr. Rice, Assistant Attorney General Rice, will argue for Lurk for 12 minutes. And then Ms. Brooks, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Agreed upon? Okay. You may proceed, counsel.
Thank you. May it please the court. I do represent Stoughton Trailers, and I'm going to be sharing a portion of my time with Ms. Lindner, who is on my right. I will address the relevant legal standards and facts that mandate the reversal of the Lurk decision in this case, and Ms. Lindner will provide a broader picture of why reversal of the decision is of critical importance to businesses in the state of Wisconsin. Because it is the less complex of the two issues, I'm going to first address the reasonable accommodation issue and address why Stoughton Trailers did not refuse to reasonably accommodate Mr. Gein's disability. I will then address why Mr. Gein was not terminated because of his disability in the first place. I do not intend to address the remedies argument issue unless otherwise requested by the court. As to the reasonable accommodation issue, Stoughton did not refuse to accommodate Mr. Gein. It bent over backwards to help him comply with its attendance policy. Briefly, a few facts and background. Mr. Dean had accumulated 4.5 out of an allowed 6 absences prior to December of 1996, and all of those initial absences had nothing to do with his disability. He received his last occurrence for an absence on January 24th of 1997, and he has never submitted any medical documentation to Stoughton Trailers, not even a note, linking that last absence to his disability. I've brought a chart which demonstrates that Stoughton repeatedly informed Mr. Gein that if he would just submit a medical certification form, that he would not receive any occurrences for absences due to his migraines, or for absences that had been assessed, or occurrences that had been assessed, they would be reversed if he would submit the medical certification form. He never submitted the form. I lifted these dates on this chart on the right from the findings of fact in the Lurk's decision. Now, Mr. Gein's absences were all for the same condition, although they spread out between December and January. I expect that Mr. Rice and Mr. Carlson will argue that these absences were in separate increments and that somehow that leads to Stoughton's alleged deficiency in how it treated Mr. Gein. But when viewed as a whole, because it's all the same condition, it's all for migraines, the facts demonstrate the reasonable accommodation of Stoughton. Starting in December 17th, that's when Stoughton first sent a request for a medical certification form for Mr. Gein. That form had a 15-day request deadline for response. January 1st is the expiration of that first deadline. There was no return form from Mr. Gein. January 8th, a person by the name of Tammy Dressler, who is in Stoughton Trailer's Human Resources Department, reminds Gein that he needs to submit the certification form. She tells him, and this is also in the facts, that if he submits the form, his occurrence for an absence in December will be reversed. On January 29th, she again reminds him after a subsequent absence that he needs to submit a completed certification form. And he sends a second written request for the certification form. Ms. Dressler sends a second request. January 31st is the termination date. And at the termination date, Dressler informs Mr. Gein that he has the opportunity to appeal to what's called the ARB, the Attendance Review Board, a peer and management commission, a committee that decides whether or not terminations will be upheld. She tells him that he has the opportunity to submit medical documentation to the ARB. Mr. Gein takes her up on that and files an appeal on February 5th. However, he doesn't provide any medical documentation to the board. Then on February 7th, Mr. Gein goes back to his doctor, but he doesn't ask the doctor to complete the medical certification form. Finally, on February 21st is the date when the ARB rejected the appeal of Mr. Gein. And although it's evident, 66 days have now passed since the first time Stoughton Trailers tells Mr. Gein that he has the right to submit this medical form.
So what do you get from all of that?
I'm sorry?
What's your conclusion from all of the facts?
The conclusion from all of that is that this demonstrates that Stoughton Trailers did attempt, quite frankly, to reasonably accommodate Mr. Gein, and that there are intervening factors which caused Mr. Gein to be terminated, and that's his own behavior by not turning in the form.
Now, the only thing you knew, and I think this was the end of January, looking at your chart, was that he did bring back, I think Gein gave Dressler a note just stating that he was being evaluated for migraines. So that was the only thing that you got.
Correct.
Yeah, that's not on the chart. So there was something that he brought back, but it was only the note, and that he was able, he was unable to work on January 27th and 28th, and that's...
The last absence that caused his termination was January 24th, and there is no note, no certification form, nothing from his doctor related to January 24th.
Is it your position that... Stoughton knows that the person is really ill, no faking, no nothing, maybe hospitalized or that's quite clear, that you can fire that person knowing of a medical disability on the grounds that he didn't supply the appropriate forms that you wanted?
Well, Lurk has concluded that an employer has a right to make reasonable requests for medical information, including when the person will be, how long it will be out, when they will be required to be absent. And so the request form, which is in the appendix, it very reasonably asks for a limited amount of information. It's a great question because in Target stores, and this is why this case is different than Target stores, the plaintiff promptly provided the employer with the same type of information from her doctor that Stoughton sought from Mr. Gein. And in Target stores, of course, Lurk considered that evidence to be critical. In Target stores, the employer then went on to disregard what the doctor had said. But here, Stoughton was faced with the prospect of not having that information at all.
So your answer to my question is yes.
Yes.
Even if you know the guys in the hospital may know that any number of things. No question. I mean, migraine headache is a little hard to... For an employer to determine whether he really did or didn't have a migraine headache. I'll put him in traction on after a ski accident, and everybody knows it, okay? Pictures are circulated. So is that's enough? Your view is he doesn't submit the forms, that's grounds for firing, and you don't fall within this statute. Is that right?
That may affect the reasonableness of the employer's actions. If the employer goes to the hospital and sees the person in the bed lying with their foot...
And fill out the form.
That would go back to the reasonableness, because the migraine headache issue is a gray area for the employer. It's not evident.
That's really the problem. You don't believe
that is the problem, yes.
Okay.
On your chart, you say on January 8th, Dressler reminds Gein to submit a completed certification form. And that was after the time it was due.
Correct.
Don't you allege in your brief that on January 31st, Dressler said that if they submitted the Department of Labor form, it would countermand the termination?
What we allege in our brief, it was based on a factual finding, is that Dressler again told him that if he submitted the form, his occurrences would be reversed. The Lurk did not make a factual finding on the issue of specifically whether or not Dressler told Gein that his termination would be reversed, although I would respectfully assert that based on the other statements by Lurk, it's implied within their other findings.
I'm not quite sure. Are these two different periods, in your view, or one period?
It's our view that it's the same condition, and that what Stoughton Trailers was trying to do was offer Mr. Gein leave for perhaps more than one occurrence based on the same condition. And whether you call that intermittent leave, it's still the same condition. And so it's clear from the record that Mr. Gein knew that with respect to any individual occurrence, if he submitted the form, he would not receive an occurrence for that absence.
Your intervening factor in this case is his failure to turn in the forms. And it's failure to turn in the forms under these circumstances. I mean, you're not asking for some kind of a bright line rule, as was elucidated by the chief's question.
That's correct.
So it's not just turn in the form or that's it. It's not, as some would argue, I guess in the next case it comes up, form over substance. it is under these circumstances where we're dealing with a migraine headache and
where the employer has the obligation to act reasonably and reasonably accommodate. That's correct, because it's not evident by the condition itself. So having offered the reasonable accommodation to Mr. Gein, Stoughton met the requirements of the WFEA. It doesn't require Stoughton to offer a separate accommodation of some sort of indefinite clemency and forbearance. But With all due respect, and in any event, we would assert that what Stoughton did was the exercise of clemency and forbearance for a reasonable amount of time, given the facts.
Counsel, why is this not a standard of review case? Why shouldn't we be providing great weight deference to LURC in its determination with respect to the reasonable accommodation standard?
Because you've seen our arguments as to why we argue de novo review, because of the inconsistency. And in fact, in some of the briefs, LURC itself has conceded that it has been inconsistent on these points.
My understanding of the inconsistency with respect to the second issue, though, was because of a decision that it rendered the first time that was reversed by the Court of Appeals. So in rendering a decision that dealt with the remand from the Court of Appeals, I'm not sure how that takes it, rises to the level of inconsistency necessary to take us to de novo review.
Our secondary position is that even under the de novo review, LURC's interpretation of the reasonable accommodation standard in this case is not reasonable and is contrary to the statute, because the statute says that an employer will be guilty of discrimination if it refuses to accommodate an employee's disability. And so Stoughton didn't refuse because it offered Mr. Gein something. What LURC is now saying is that, well, that's fine, but what we're saying is we have a preferred accommodation. And so it's clearly contrary to the meaning of the statute, because since Stoughton offered something, it can't be a refusal. And so LURC is urging an additional a specified accommodation requirement that's not included in the statute.
Well, what exactly is the preferred accommodation?
LURC, in its briefs, suggests that the preferred accommodation is that Stoughton should have engaged or should have allowed some sort of indefinite clemency and forbearance to allow Mr. Gein to continue to work through these issues, even in the absence of the medical information.
Didn't the administrative law judge originally say, let's just take this whole period and make it one occurrence?
I'm sorry, I'm not recalling. It has been almost 10 years. The LURC's original decision viewed it as a series of requests related to the same type of condition.
Yeah, but LURC's original decision reversed the administrative law judge's decision that it should all be just one continuous period.
I'm not recalling the exact words. My recollection is that the administrative law judge divided it into separate periods of absence, and that the LURC reversed him on those grounds originally, and then reversed itself in the second opinion. I'm going to move on and briefly address the because of analysis, because my time is running short. The because of issue is presented first in the briefs, because LURC has repeatedly concluded and stated that only if the plaintiff has succeeded on the because of issue does the analysis get to the reasonable accommodation analysis. And that's confirmed as recently as the SIL decision by the Labor and Industry Review Commission, which postdates its commission decision in our own case. The because of issue appears to be complicated, but it actually can be broken down, so it's not as complex as it appears. Mr. Gein had accumulated 75% of his absences for non-disability related reasons. And his last absence, he doesn't even have a note supporting the need for the leave. Now, except for the Commission's September 23rd decision in this case, the Commission had applied a clear and consistent rule of law that it's not discrimination because of disability for an employer to terminate an employee for violating the employer's attendance policy when the majority of the absences causing the termination are not related to the disability. And the Commission's most recent confirmation of this rule postdates the Commission's decision in our case. And again, that's the SIL case, which was decided on August 26 of 2005. And in SIL, the Commission reconfirmed that when only 3 of 11 absences of an employee's absences were related to her disability, that it's not discrimination because of disability to terminate her for absenteeism. And in that decision, the Commission focused on what it called the significant factors leading to the termination. In the case at hand, Mr. Gein's non-disability-related absences were more significant, just in sheer number, and there's an intervening factor that he failed to submit medical information requested by Stoughton. And we would assert that those two factors are more significant than the underlying disability, 1.5 disability-related occurrences in this case. We've explained why we think HOLE doesn't work. You cannot find discriminatory intent in a facially neutral policy. It just logically doesn't work. Mr. Gein could have pled a disparate impact claim if he was claiming that the policy had a disparate impact on people with disabilities, but he did not. Another reason that HOLE does not work is because it has no allowance for more significant or other intervening factors. Hence, it's not a Chicken Little sky is falling argument to suggest that the first occurrence out of 50, if that was the only disability-related absence, then the employer would be guilty of discriminating against the employee because of disability. Now, in the decisions since this September 3rd, 2003 decision, the Commission itself has not applied HOLE, even in cases involving discriminatory intent. And that was in the Nelson case, Nelson versus State Historical Society. And, of course, the Commission did not apply HOLE in the Seil case. Instead, the Commission cited Gordon and Gee in the Seil case. If this Court desires to articulate a more clear standard than what's provided in Gordon and Gee and Seil, then it should reaffirm the Commission's articulated position on this issue, which is what I call the significant factor test, which is described in Seil. I see that I'm out of time. Ms. Linder.
Thank you, Counsel. We will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Thank you. Ms. Linder.
May it please the Court. My name is Laura Linder, and I represent Amicus Party, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. When the Wisconsin legislature included disability as among the protected classes for discrimination and included the duty to accommodate in the Fair Employment Act, it struck a necessary balance between the interests of employers and employees. And that balance is perhaps most difficult to strike in the context of absenteeism, which is the context in which the issues before this Court have arisen. Now, like all employers, Wisconsin employers are struggling with increasing employee absenteeism and the significant direct and indirect costs of that absenteeism. The failure of a Wisconsin manufacturer to meet productivity standards due to employee absenteeism so increased that manufacturer's production costs that the price of its products became uncompetitive. The failure of a Wisconsin business to timely respond to customer needs due to employee absenteeism resulted in that Wisconsin business losing customers. These are not hypothetical examples. Wisconsin employers are under tremendous pressure, given that their competitors are no longer local. They are in different states, they are in different countries, and they are not subject to Wisconsin law. Now, affirming Lurk's ruling that Stoughton Trailers discriminated against Mr. Gein by terminating his employment places Wisconsin employers at risk of liability for using no-fault attendance policies, policies which are used across the country to manage the cost of absenteeism. And the error of Lurk is that it's very clear and very simple. Stoughton Trailers attendance policy is a neutral, no-fault attendance policy. Mr. Gein would have been terminated regardless of the reasons for his absences unless they were excluded from the policy or otherwise protected by law. So he cannot show discriminatory intent. That is no different than the types of other neutral policies that employers use regularly. as this court addressed in the Hutchinson Technologies case, where the employer had a 12-hour shift requirement. In the situation in Target stores, another case that's been briefed in this case, where the employer had an anti-loafing policy. Neither this court in Hutchinson Technologies nor the Court of Appeals in Target stores held that the 12-hour shift requirement or the anti-loafing policy were discriminatory. What the courts correctly said is the issue is reasonable accommodation. So the mistake here is that LURC has issued a ruling that says by terminating Mr. Gein for absences that were in fact disability-related, you now have per se discrimination by application of that policy.
Counsel, if we accept your position, do we not have to overturn the whole decision that was referred to by Ms. Brooks?
I don't think so, Judge. In whole, the issue was one of a mixed motive, where there was actually evidence of a discriminatory intent, as well as a non-discriminatory intent. This is not a mixed motive case. Again, this is a neutral policy. Yes, Mr. Gein's absences were disability-related, but like the Hutchinson Technologies case, the employee could not meet a 12-hour shift requirement. But the court didn't say, okay, the 12-hour shift requirement is per se discriminatory. What the court said is you're going to need to accommodate that person and make an adjustment in applying the 12-hour shift requirement to this employee. But we have two findings in this case. We have one, a finding by LURC, that the application of the no-fault attendance policy is discriminatory. And we have another finding that Stoughton Trailers refused to accommodate Mr. Gein. So I submit it's a very easy decision to make that because intent is not at issue.
Because what is not at issue?
Intent is not at issue, that the first finding of LURC, that the termination was because of disability, must be reversed. I also submit that the court need not then get into a determination as to what the proper test applies here, whether it's determining factor, whether it's motivating factor, whether it's in part, whether it's something else. Those tests apply when you have either a case of mixed motive where intent is at issue or just a straight disparate treatment intent case. So it is the accommodation question that this court must resolve. Now, turning to that issue, LURC ruled that Stoughton Trailers should have suspended enforcement of its attendance policy for some indefinite period of time. And it did so without knowing precisely what the nature of Mr. Gein's condition was. This is not an obvious condition, as you know, he's in the hospital laid up due to some kind of accident. He didn't supply any medical documentation, unlike the plaintiff in Target stores, stating, you know, here's my condition, here's my treatment plan, I expect that within a month I will know whether this treatment's working. None of that was supplied by Mr. Gein. Now, in light of that ruling, WMC has heard from many of its 4,000-plus members that they do not know what they can and cannot do when an employee does not show up for work and does not provide medical information as to the employee's status, when that status is not obvious. They ask, well, can we enforce our attendance policies if an employee cannot maintain regular attendance and cannot adequately perform their job duties? Can we require an employee to provide medical documentation justifying suspension of an attendance policy? Can we enforce our attendance policy when the employee does not provide timely documentation justifying the need for some temporary suspension of a policy? The implication of LURC's ruling is that the answer to those questions is no. And that leaves employers guessing as to how they are going to be able to manage employees who don't show up for work. And the implications of this ruling for Wisconsin employers is costly. It's especially costly for small and medium employers who don't have the flexibility or the resources to adapt to the unpredictable absenteeism that they're facing. And it gives a competitive advantage to employers outside Wisconsin, where the answers to those questions that we're hearing from the WMC members is yes. Yes, you can discharge somebody if you've asked them for medical documentation and they repeatedly fail to provide it for you and you otherwise have no understanding as to when they might come back to work.
Now, counsel, I'm sympathetic, of course, to having people understand what the law is so that they can follow it. That's quite clear, and that employers as well as the employees ought to know what their rights are, right?
Yes, and the law requires that employers advise employees of their rights.
And that, you know, the employee has a detriment if they don't understand the law and get fired, right? Do you view this as a statutory interpretation case?
I do, in the sense that we're talking about the breadth of the scope of the duty to accommodate. Yes.
What do you think should be the standard and how we interpret it?
Well, the standard is what the statute says, what is reasonable. And I think you look at the facts of this case, and what is reasonable is exactly what Stoughton Trailers did.
And reasonable doesn't mean pro-business or anti-business.
It doesn't mean pro-business. It doesn't mean anti-business.
It doesn't mean pro-employee or anti-employee.
It doesn't
mean. This is a balance.
It means a fair balancing of interests. And I submit to you.
So should we consider the competitive advantage or disadvantage globally or nationally?
Well, I think it needs to be considered when you're weighing the burdens, because I think, you know, the burden placed on employers of affirming Lurk's ruling here far outweighs the burden placed on employees of reversing Lurk's ruling, which
is a judicial decision or a legislative one.
That's part of the interpretation of what's reasonable. Here all the employee needed to do was provide medical documentation explaining what their situation was.
That's the issue, isn't it?
That's the heart of the matter.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Carlson.
Please, the Court. My name is John Carlson, and I represent Douglas Keene. This is a case about whether employers can use their so-called no-fault attendance policies to escape their duty to reasonably accommodate disabled workers under the WFEA.
Is this also a case about fairness to both sides? Is it a case about statutory interpretation?
I would think every case is about fairness to
yep.
both sides.
Sure.
This case is not about precluding employers' use of no-fault attendance policies or finding them per se discriminatory, as Stoughton and WMC suggest. This case does not mark Armageddon for Wisconsin businesses.
Why is that, counsel?
Because I don't think that this decision will imperil the ongoing use of these policies as long as they're applied in a manner that's consistent with WFEA law.
So you think that particularly in a smaller business, 8 or 10 people, that failure to at least respond to what may be wrong with you is something that this court should uphold?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear all that.
In a smaller business,
uh-huh.
What effect, if any, will this have if the court goes with your position?
I think it would have a beneficial impact, especially because Stoughton relies so heavily in their claim for reasonable accommodation on their compliance with the FMLA. The FMLA does not even apply to some businesses. Lurk's no. findings of fact in this case haven't been challenged based on substantial evidence standards, so the issues in this case are primarily or exclusively legal. It's unnecessary, therefore, to review the extensive procedural history or the record, but a few salient facts are worthy of mention, especially because I don't have a display like my adversary does.
So well, do you agree with that display?
I can't see it from here too well, but it's probably reasonably accurate. But let me just go through what I think are the important facts quickly. Douglas Keene was terminated after 8 years of dedicated service to Stoughton for exceeding the permissible number of 6 occurrences in a 12-month period. The last 2 occurrences related to 2 discrete periods, December 12th to January 7th, and then later January 24th through January 30th. Importantly, Lurk specifically found, in its finding of fact number 27, that these periods, including January 24th, were caused by Keene's disability, namely his experiencing migraines. During the latter period, January 24th through the 30th, Keene called into his employer on the mornings of the days that he missed work due to his migraines, and he had doctor's appointments on January 28th and January 30th. On January 29th, Stoughton's Human Resources Administrator, Ms. Dressler, gave Mr. Gein a standard letter notifying him that for his absences to qualify as FMLA leave and to avoid being assessed an occurrence, he needed to return the attached DOL form within 15 days. And the findings also indicate that she verbally emphasized that fact to him. On January 30th, Gein went back to his doctor and was diagnosed with migraines. And his doctor wrote a note saying that he was being evaluated for migraines. And it's undisputed that Gein gave this note to Dressler the same day.
That's the only medical information. I asked your opposing counsel that was the only medical information that they had was that note.
According to the findings of fact, that I think that is correct. But he did provide verbal information as well.
Why was the Department of Labor form never filed in either instance?
I was just about to get to that. It's a good question. I think one of the reasons is that if you look at the form itself, it's not evident that that form could even be completed given the nascent stage of diagnosis and treatment that Mr. Gein was undergoing. If you look at the questions, among other things, the form requests the probable duration of the patient's condition and the patient's present incapacity. Another item, if additional treatments will be required, provide an estimate of the probable number of such treatments. Significantly, even after Gein submitted his appeal, after having been terminated on January 31st, after having timely submitted his appeal, on February 7th, he had a follow-up exam with Dr. Hansen, who again changed his medication treatment. So his treatment stage was still in an evolutionary stage. There were alternative drug treatment therapies being explored. And it's not evident to me that these questions could be answered effectively.
Did he ask Dr. Hansen to fill out the form?
I don't know specifically if he used those words. He certainly went back to his doctor and asked for additional medical information. On January 30th, he provided the note. In response to that note, Ms. Dressler then requested him to get another note, and what she specifically said to him was she needed a note to have him be able to return to work without restrictions. So he goes back to the doctor the next day on the 31st, obtains another note from the doctor releasing him to work, and the doctor provides excuses, but for some reason overlooked the 24th, probably through oversight. And at that point, Gein told his doctor, Gein returned to Dressler and told her that his doctor needed additional time to evaluate him before he could bring in more medical documentation. So he actually communicated that to her. In the record,
why couldn't the doctor have said, "I'm not in a position to fill out the Department of Labor form," or I'm not in a position to do what you want?
I can't get into the doctor's mind. All I can say is from doing injury law, communications between patients and doctors are not always clear, and sometimes the information requested isn't always the information that you get back. I don't know definitively why that's the case, but I think the important thing is that he did go back and ask for additional information and was told by his doctor that he needed more time before he could supply it. And in fact, the hearing, if you look at the record at page 120, the hearing transcript indicates that Gein told Dressler his doctor had informed him he needed at least a week to submit additional documentation. And yet, notwithstanding that communication, she terminates him and gives him only 3 days to submit his appeal.
Would you dispute the allegation by your opposing counsel that on the 31st, Mr. Gein was told that if he ever submitted the Department of Labor form within the time period, that that occurrence would be reversed?
I would, because I don't think it's in the findings of fact. I think that she cited to hearing transcript for that finding. I think that he was told, if you look at the findings, he was told, you have 3 days to submit an appeal. That's what's in the findings of fact.
Well, let me ask then. Things that are not in the findings of fact should not be cited?
I'm not saying they shouldn't be cited, but I think that they're more subject to dispute if they're not findings of fact. The findings of fact would have to be challenged on a substantial evidence standard, which hasn't been done. Anyway, getting to the issue that I originally was planned to discuss here, I was going to address the because of issue.
You were going to address the legal issue. I'll try to streamline it. I have a question.
Oh, okay.
I have a question. You discuss, and of course reasonableness is part of the equation in the analysis here, but you discuss what was done by your client on going to the doctor on the 28th and 30th and communication with Dressler regarding that and the doctor's note on the 30th. And then your client went back on the 31st, and I think another note was provided by the doctor. If you didn't have those facts, let me just focus on the facts that are the subject of this display that we have before us. And the facts there include a December 17th request for medical certification. None came. January 8th reminder, you need a certification. None came. A January 29th reminder to submit a completed certification form and a second written request for certification form. None came. And termination.
Correct.
Is your legal position different with those facts?
Is my legal position different?
Huh?
My legal position would be that for the first, the critical occurrence was the last occurrence. Sure, it's the same condition, but Gein was assessed an occurrence for the first period of absence. That's a discrete occurrence. Thereafter, the next discrete period for which he was assessed occurrence was January 24th through the 30th. On the 29th, Ms. Dressler requests that he return the DOL form. Stoughton hangs its hat on the compliance with the FMLA as its reasonable accommodation. It didn't comply. The regulation states that once you request that the employee provide the certification, you have to give at least 15 days. And the Rager case confirms that, the Seventh Circuit case I cited in my brief. So I would submit that aside from the FMLA, we don't think there was a reasonable accommodation. We think clemency and forbearance was the necessary accommodation in this case. But even if you're willing to be under these particular circumstances because of the stage of his diagnosis and treatment, but even if you're willing to assume the possibility of reasonable accommodation being equated with the FMLA, which I think is a bad idea in general, they didn't comply. They didn't give him the 15 days.
That's, you need the discrete occurrence before you get to the...
Well, what triggers the 15-day requirement is a request. The employer is not obligated under the federal FMLA guidelines to make a request, but if they do, they must, according to the statute, provide the employee with at least 15 days. They fired him 2 days later.
Counsel, with respect to the standard of review, and specifically with respect to the because of standard.
Sure.
The Court of Appeals applied a due weight standard of review in their decision.
Correct.
Given the G and Gordon decisions, which from LIRC, which are referenced in the brief of opposing counsel. Did the Court of Appeals get it right, or should we be looking at this as de novo?
Well, I would say they either got it right or should have applied a great weight standard, because there's not an inconsistency with those decisions. If you look at Gordon, the because of issue was not even decided. LIRC based its decision on the employee's inability to do the job in the absence of any, not only any reasonable accommodation, but even any conceivable accommodation. And while LIRC noted it was difficult to find disparate treatment in the application of a facially neutral attendance policy, LIRC also emphasized that the handicap was really one with the ability to perform the work in view of the handicap. As I was going to try to discuss, this is really more of a disparate impact case than a disparate treatment case. We're talking about disability-related occurrences that affect a discrete group of people, disabled people, not the people that don't have disabilities. And it's a very established part of our jurisprudence that disparate impact claims are cognizable under Wisconsin law, including under the WFEA. The whole decision notes that. And in fact, what's especially persuasive in that regard is a case that was misleadingly cited by WMC. They provided a partial quote that, if you look at the full quote, actually supports Keene's position. I'll just read that to you.
This is from which case?
This is in Racine Unified School District. The quote reads in full, Wisconsin law recognizes two theories of employment discrimination, the disparate impact theory and the disparate treatment theory. The disparate impact theory is invoked to attack facially neutral policies, which, although applied evenly, impact more heavily on a protected group, citing Griggs, a seminal U.S. Supreme Court case. Under the disparate treatment theory, the complainant must show that the employer treats some people less favorably than others because they belong to a protected class. Thus, a complainant asserting a disparate treatment theory must prove discriminatory intent to prevail, while a complainant asserting a disparate impact theory need not offer any such proof. And furthermore, as to this sort of segues into the whole argument that the import test is inappropriate because it's an intent-based test. Wisconsin Telephone v. Diller, the court said, the broad purpose of the Fair Employment Act is to eliminate practices that have a discriminatory impact as well as practices which on their face amount to invidious discrimination. And finally, in McMullen, a disability case, the court actually rejected a disparate treatment theory but still held that the employer failed to reasonably accommodate the employee by denying him a job transfer. So clearly, disparate impact cases are recognized. There's no reason not to apply the impart test. But even if it's not applied under the determining factor test, Gein would still win because but for his disability-related occurrences, he wouldn't have been terminated.
I'm referring to paragraph 21 of the Court of Appeals decision. What about the fact that LIRC conceded that it took a somewhat different approach than in previous cases addressing similar issues?
I think what they were saying is they drew the line differently. And I'm glad you brought that up because I think the model that they proposed in this kind of case is a case-by-case basis on the because of issue whereby you assess the total number of occurrences compared to the number of disability-related occurrences. There will be a spectrum in each case. In some cases, even in the first LIRC decision, they conceded that the number of disability-related occurrences would be, compared to the total number, would be so high that there would be a finding of termination because of disability. It's my contention that this court really should recognize any occurrence as satisfying the because of question, because even one occurrence is a decision based in part on an impermissible factor. This does not mean that there is discrimination necessarily, because the employee still has to prove in the first place that he or she is disabled, number one. And secondly, even if there's a finding of termination because of disability, which can't be conflated necessarily with discrimination because of disability. And that's something that I think my opponent has gotten confused over. Even if there's a finding of termination because of disability, the employer still has the defenses of no reasonable accommodation and hardship. And I think that's where the proper balance should be struck.
And
I think my time is up.
Yes. Thank you. Assistant Attorney General David Rice, representing LIRC.
May it please the Court, I'm David Rice. I'm an Assistant Attorney General. I appear on behalf of the Labor and Industry Review Commission. This is the third of three cases in which I've appeared before you in the last few years dealing with this issue of reasonable accommodation. The last of which was Hutchinson Technology, where this Court said, and this echoes what WMC says, a business must have the right to set its own employment rules to encourage maximum productivity. The Commission doesn't disagree with that in any way. But what the Court went on to say was that such rules do not exist in a vacuum, but must bend to the requirements of the WFEA, the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act. Justice Sykes and Justice Wilcox concurred, saying that they were bound by the decision in Crystal Lake, and that if there were to be a different result, it would be for the legislature and not for this Court to come to a different conclusion. Now, what is reasonable? What does the statute require? The statute requires that an employer make reasonable accommodation of an employee's disability. What's reasonable, the Court of Appeals said in McMullen, depends on the specific facts of each individual case. In that case, in McMullen, they said a reasonable accommodation may involve the transfer of an individual from one job to another. In Target Stores, another Court of Appeals decision, the Court said, reasonable accommodation may require a leave of absence or forbearance from enforcing a work rule while an employee is undergoing medical evaluation and treatment. In that case, they noted a reasonably short time frame would be required to see if the treatment worked. Unlike what the Manufacturers and Commerce Association argues here, the Commission did not decide in this case that an indefinite exception from the no-fault attendance policy should be given to Mr. Gein. Rather, they said that there should be an opportunity to see if the medications that were given to Mr. Gein would have a desirable effect in terms of reducing the number of migraine headaches. I'll get to that in a minute. I think the Court is concerned with the specific facts of this case, and I reread the entire transcript last night, and I'd like to share with you some of those facts and why I think this chart is an error. In the Frito-Lay case...
Which parts you think are in error?
Sorry?
And you'll tell us which parts...
There's actually only one line that's an error.
Okay, tell us.
May I proceed? Yep. Finish first, or do you want to answer the question right now?
Answer the question and then proceed.
Fine. The answer to the question is, under the policy of Stoughton Trailers, you can group days of absence together to be a particular occurrence. You can even group absences over a period of time to be a single occurrence. In this case, it's suggested by this chart that there was a single occurrence that began in December and ran all the way through the time of his termination. The line that I disagree with says that there was a second form given on January 29th to Mr. Gein, essentially a reminder to get in the form that he hadn't gotten in before. Well, if that's the position they're taking, then under their own policy, there was only a single occurrence here for this entire lack of absence. He would only have occurred five absences. He wouldn't have passed the sixth. We wouldn't be here today. The fact is, Stoughton Trailer didn't treat it as a single absence. They treated it as two discrete absences, assessed occurrence for the absences in December, and assessed a separate occurrence for the absences in January. You can't have it both ways. If they want this chart to control, then they should concede that he didn't violate their policy and they should put him back to work. But in fact, that doesn't reflect the evidence in the case. Now, to go back to where I was in summarizing some of the case law, in Frito-Lay, a case where this court, by equally divided court, affirmed the decision of the Court of Appeals, the Court of Appeals concluded that a reasonable accommodation would include assigning a truck driver to only intrastate runs where his medical condition wouldn't preclude his interstate operations. In Crystal Lake, this court held that a reasonable accommodation includes requiring an employer to modify the job duties of an employee and make physical modifications of the workplace. And in Hutchinson Technology, this court held that a reasonable accommodation might permit an employee to work an 8-hour shift rather than a 12-hour shift. What we have in this case is a question of whether the employer would give the employee sufficient time to determine whether a new medication would work in reducing his migraine headaches. And I'll get to the facts of that in just 1 minute. The only other thing I want to say first, well,
When was there a new medication?
Well, I'll get to that in just 1 minute. I just wanted to respond to one thing that Ms. Lindner said before I forget. The commission here is not saying that no-fault attendance policies may not be used by employers. In fact, they are probably a good management tool, and they eliminate invidious discrimination because they're uniformly applied without fault. The decision in this case will not cause employers to have to abandon the use of no-fault attendance policies. Justice Abramson raised the question of, well, what about a migraine headache? How do we know if it's a disability or not? The Court of Appeals recently in the Depke Klein case cited in my brief held that a migraine headache wasn't always a disability. So first of all, the Act is only going to afford protection to persons who have disabilities within the meaning of the Act. In this case, that was conceded. Maybe it shouldn't have been conceded, but it was, so that's not an issue here. In other cases like Depke Klein, that was the litigated issue. Secondly, even if you're a person with a disability, if the disability prevents you from doing the job, from coming to work, then you don't have to keep the person. You can terminate the person's employment. In the WMC's brief, they suggest, I think it was an example of a person applying for a job with a typist who didn't have the physical ability to be able to type. Well, that's just like Griggs versus Duke Power. You don't have to keep somebody who can't do the job if they can't do the job with a reasonable accommodation that doesn't impose a hardship. So it's the no-fault attendance policies will go on except in those limited cases where a person has a disability and where the disability can be reasonably accommodated without undue hardship to the employer. That's the kind of issue that we have today. Now let's quickly talk about the facts of this particular case. Mr. Gein had already incurred his fifth of six occurrences before he was absent on January 24th. January 24th is a Friday in 1997. The 29th was a Monday, 30th, and so on. So the 23rd, for some reason, he took a day of vacation. And you'll see that the Attendance Review Board and everybody else is confused in this case about the 23rd. But that really isn't much of a dispute. The commission found that he was on vacation that day, and so we're really talking about the 24th and subsequent days of absence. It's actually the 24th, the 27th is a Monday, the 28th is a Tuesday. Those are the 3 days that were in dispute. So Mr. Gein calls in on the 24th, he calls in on the 27th, he calls in on the 27th, 8th. There's no question but that he's complied with the company policy. On the 29th, he reports back to work, and the supervisor says, I don't think you can go back to work without a note from the doctor. Go see the people in personnel. He was told to go to the doctor's office and get a form saying that he could return to work. He goes to the doctor, and he gets a note from Dr. Hansen. Dr. Hansen says, this patient is being evaluated for migraines. This is the note he brings back to Ms. Dressler on the 30th. This was after the 29th, when on the 29th she'd given him the form and says, you've got 15 days to get your medical information. So he brings that form back, and she said, that's not good enough because that doesn't say you can work without restrictions, that you can return to work. So he goes back to the doctor on the 31st, and he asks the receptionist. If you look at Complainant's Exhibit 3, he asks somebody in the doctor's office for an excuse for the 27th and 28th. He didn't mention the 24th, and my surmise is that's why they didn't put it in the note. But you can look at Exhibit 3. And
why do you get to surmise that?
We don't know why they didn't put the 24th. We don't know if Gein told the
why couldn't he clarify that?
Right. We don't know if he told the medical. I'll get to that. We don't know if he told the medical assistant or if the medical assistant just misunderstood. We don't know why that. But look at Exhibit 3, and it's only the note says he needs an excuse only for the 27th, the 28th. We don't know why that is. So he comes back with a note on the 30th that says he was seen on the 30th. He was unable to work on the 27th and 28th, and it's okay for him to return to work without restrictions. Now, what about the failure to provide information about the 24th. It doesn't make any difference, because if he had brought back a note saying he was absent on the 24th, the 27th, and 28th, under the employer's policy, unless he completes the DOL form and gets it in, it's going to be treated as, under the no-fault policy, as an occurrence for those 3 days. And he's only going to, the only accommodation here, and they say they've offered an accommodation and we don't get to pick and choose, but there has been no reasonable accommodation offered, because he comes back and on the 30th, first with that thing, and it doesn't show the 24th, and Dressler fires him. And significantly, what she tells him is, you have 3 days to go to the Administrative Review Board and to present medical documentation. And he says, I can't get that. I just went to my doctor, and the doctor says it's going to take a week. Now, maybe Judge Albert was not charitable in saying that he was not the brightest guy and maybe not even union steward material. But if you read this record, you come away with an understanding that he doesn't fully understand how the DOL form works and what he has to submit. And the point is, he was told that he had to do it within 3 days, and when those 3 days expired, it was his understanding that he couldn't submit medical documentation anymore. To you and to the rest of us and to Stoughton Trailers and to their Human Resources Department, sure, why didn't he submit it later? You know, why didn't they say to him, you know, we really need to have this in by such and such a date, and if you don't, then your employment's going to be terminated. All she told him was that he didn't submit the information for the 24th. He goes to the review board. The review board, according to Ms. Dressler in her testimony, could have extended the time. They didn't extend the time. Of course, that was because they were focused on the 23rd and weren't even focused on the 24th or the real reason that he was terminated. So the problem in this case, he went to the doctor and was prescribed a drug. Let me see what the name of that drug was. It doesn't really matter.
Paxil.
It wasn't Paxil. It started with an A. But in any event, he went there, and then when he went back on the 7th, they said that he'd only had one migraine headache since then, so it was beginning to have some positive effect. The problem with this case, really, is that Mr. Gein did not have a disability rights organization working with him. It didn't have a union steward working with him. It didn't have a lawyer working with him who could have guided him to get that kind of information in. But what happened here on the first occurrence, he didn't get it in. They reasonably assessed a penalty against him at occurrence. The second time, they didn't even give him the 15 days. They terminated him after 2 days.
Where's his right to 15 days?
Sorry?
Where is his right to 15 days?
I don't know that he has a right to 15 days, and I don't think it matters whether it's 10 days or 12 days.
FMLA?
According to the Court of Appeals, it's 15 days, and they disagree with Stoughton Trailers. The Commission doesn't profess to be experts in the FMLA and would yield to the decision of the, defer to the decision of the Court of Appeals.
Okay.
I see my time has expired.
Go ahead, Justice Prosser.
In terms of the remedy for the employee, was the employee given the maximum remedy by LIRC?
That's my understanding, that he was given maximum in the sense of reinstatement, back pay, and attorney's fees.
And that maximum remedy would have been equivalent to the penalty for deliberate, invidious discrimination. Is that correct?
That's correct.
How can you justify that?
Well, the purpose of the Fair Employment Act, according to the decisions of this court, in Anderson and in Watkins, is to make the employee whole for the employer's wrongful conduct. If the employer engages in conduct which violates the statute, there's a presumption that the person is entitled to reinstatement, back pay, interest on back pay, and attorney's fees. That's what this court has said. And now, in the whole case,
Mr. Rice, yep. That the LIRC said that the employer hadn't done anything wrong.
Well, if the employer had not done anything wrong in this case, they wouldn't have found a violation of the statute. In fact, they found that the employer violated the act by failing to reasonably accommodate Mr. Gein's disability. And that's why they assessed.
The first time they didn't, they found that there was no violation
right.
of the act. They dismissed the case.
The first time they did that because they believed, and I think correctly, that Mr. Gein had not provided the information necessary on the first, the second to the last occurrence. And therefore, he'd failed to cooperate, and it wasn't the employer's fault that he'd incurred this additional time. When it came back from Judge Albert, and ultimately affirmed by the Court of Appeals, the commission was told otherwise. The commission was told that that's not right, that there was a failure to reasonably accommodate on the last occurrence, and that that's a violation. And the commission took it back, heeded the words of the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals, and reached the decision that it did.
Well, I'll have to see if I can understand this case. We have two issues because of, which you didn't touch on, but Mr. Carlson did,
right,
and reasonable accommodation.
Correct.
And my understanding, at least from your brief, on because of, is that where you might have a legitimate grounds for firing somebody, namely, guy was absent, and a violation grounds for firing, namely, sick, disabled, I shouldn't use sick, disability. Now, where you have both in play, then disability issue comes to the fore, and it's not cured by the legitimate grounds. Is that right?
Right. I think that if you look at the whole case on page, it's 186 with second, and then there's this off-cited paragraph about how you do remedies. If it was a factor but it wouldn't have made any difference, you get less a remedy. And if it was a factor and it made a difference, you get a greater remedy.
Okay. So that affects the remedy.
That affects the remedy.
The fact that there's a statutory violation in because of, even if it's 2 days versus 5 days,
right,
that is a because of. That's enough under the statute. That's how you interpret the words because of.
Yes.
I don't have to accept it, but that's your position.
That's correct.
All right. Then on reasonable accommodation, when I look at that, and I see, hey, all they're asking this guy to do is fill out a form. The form doesn't fit, then you fill it out and you say, not applicable, right? See schedule attached, right? I mean, that's how we fill out forms here. That's how I fill out forms. And yet, he doesn't fill out the form. Now, is it your position that the fact that he brought in these medical notes is good enough to satisfy Stoughton's perfectly good work rule, bring in the form? Is it your position that accepting the medical note was a reasonable accommodation or should have been a reasonable accommodation for the form? Or is it your position that a reasonable accommodation here had to take his oral statements and these medical notes, look at it all together, and say, well, we don't know whether he's disabled or not in the extent, and therefore we have to ride with him for a while? I mean, I want to know what is the unreasonable accommodation or not reasonable accommodation.
No. Exactly. I think the best way to answer that question is to focus on the two separate occurrences. On the first occurrence, he was allowed the opportunity to submit the information. He was given more than 15 days. He was given plenty of time. He never took the initiative to get anything in, and I think was properly assessed an occurrence. And I think Judge Albert at least agreed with that analysis. On the second group of occurrences, what was different is that he brought in a report from the doctor that says he's being evaluated. He told the Administrative Review Board in his written appeal, I'm being evaluated for migraine headaches. He told Dressler that this is going to take at least a week, that if for whatever reasons my doctor won't give me any information for a week. What was unreasonable here was to summarily fire him after 2 days to tell him that he only had 3 days, when it was his understanding he couldn't get anything in less than a week, that he only had 3 days to submit his medical information, and to at least not wait a short period of time for the doctor to report back. Had they waited, they would have discovered that this new drug was having a beneficial effect, and that with that medication, he might reasonably have returned to work. The doctor could have completed the DOL form, and the occurrence wouldn't have been assessed, and he'd still be working there.
Okay. My next question is, Wisconsin has its own FEA, right?
Correct.
Which other states might not have.
Most do now, but yes, that's correct.
To what extent do we figure in the fact that you've got Wisconsin with this rule? How do we figure that in competitiveness, business, effect on business? I mean, you agree business ought to know what it can and can't do, right?
Absolutely.
And they ought to have a clear view, right?
Right, except that the word reasonable accommodation, like any other use of the word reasonable in law, creates some ambiguity in advising your clients. But it's this kind of case law, common law development that gives guidance. Now, in terms of countrywide, we have the Americans with Disabilities Act, and we have regulations that are promulgated under that act, which define the kinds of accommodations which at least the federal government considers reasonable. And they include things like giving leaves of absences or short periods of time for a person to be able to submit and to first to be evaluated by a physician and then to submit the medical information showing whether the person will be able to do the job or not.
This act only covers employers over 50, is that right?
Which act?
The Wisconsin Act. Or does
it covers
cover everybody?
Wisconsin covers everybody. The FMLA and the ADA have some limitations by size.
That's where I got the 50 from. Okay. Mm-hmm. Are there any other questions?
No, Chief.
Okay. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor.
My light's off. Do you want me to proceed, even though that's buzzing in the background?
Well, let's just wait a couple of seconds and not try to talk over it. Except I will say the marshal ought to report that it is not as loud as usual. And usually we have flashing lights in at least four parts of the room, and it's only flashing in one part. And I sort of miss the other three parts. And the noise. Okay, you may proceed.
I would like to briefly address some of the points raised by both Mr. Rice and Mr. Carlson. The first has to do with the claim that Mr. Gein either couldn't fill out the forms or didn't have enough time, or that there was something that Stoughton did wrong in that regard. When the LURC first got this case, it reviewed the facts, and it found Mr. Gein's presentation on that point lacking. It concluded at pages 11 and 12 of its decision, that Gein was repeatedly told of his option of taking FMLA leave, and there is no reason to believe that he was unaware of it or what he needed to do. Immediately following that conclusion, LURC also stated that it determined that his actions were a refusal to provide medical information. And the court goes on to say that why, in light of an employee refusing to find, the commission pointed out that when an employee refuses to provide the medical information, it does not require the employer to overlook its attendance.
Okay, now, Mr. Rice, and I was going to ask this question, he said, well, yes, he should have been assessed absence the first time because he didn't do it 15 days. That's an assumption, as I gather it, that when the commission looked at this again, they said, well, the first time they didn't really count. So they're starting to count this, if I understand it, from the last time, which was the January 24th through 27th when you received the note. Is that a fair assessment of what happened here? In other words, the concession, there wasn't a concession. He just said they didn't, that was reasonable to do that.
Yes. Yes.
So Stoughton's position, as I gather, is that they should have counted the first time.
Well, Stoughton did count the first time.
Right. I understand that. But the commission.
Right. And should have counted the second time. Right. Because the commission, what it found was, look, he knows what he's supposed to do. He knows he won't get occurrences. He just repeatedly refuses to do so. And they use the word refuse in their first decision.
And, counsel, the reason he's not going to get additional occurrences is because it relates back to the first one. Is that correct?
Well, Stoughton's policy, and there's nothing improper about this, states that when absences are grouped together and then you return back to work, you'll start getting a new occurrence each time you're out again, even if it's all related to the entire medical condition. If unless you turn in the certification form, then you don't get any occurrence.
And by turning in the certification form, that links it back to the earlier occurrence, which is why it just continues as one occurrence. Am I understanding that correctly?
No, not quite. Right. It has to do with when the absences actually fall in terms of the working day. If an employee has separate absences that are where they return to work in between, and then comes back to work and has another set of absences, even if it's related to the same condition, they're going to get two occurrences for that. Unless they bring in the form at which, under these facts, at any point, then they get zero. The second point I want to briefly raise is what Mr. Carlson raised about the disparate impact theory. That's not a theory that's been raised in this case. It's not briefed in this case. And it's not the evidence that the complainant presented at hearing is not sufficient to prove a disparate impact case. Disparate impact must be proved by statistical evidence significant to the confidence level required by law comparing the policy's effect on an employee versus non-disabled employees. They haven't made that presentation at all. I just happen to have with me the Kazmierczak versus City of Stevens Point. It's a LURC decision. It's not cited in our brief because the plaintiff did not raise a disparate impact theory before today. Another point I would like to raise is it's not our suggestion that Wisconsin should govern its accommodation analysis based on a federal law. That's not the point. The point is that if the federal law didn't apply, then Stoughton would have an obligation to provide an accommodation that would work. But to conclude that a leave of absence under the FMLA would never be an accommodation is uncalled for, because sometimes a leave of absence is just exactly what the employee needs. Here I heard Mr. Rice arguing that, we talk about Mr. Gein remedying his behaviors and coming back so he was a better attending employee. That's not the reason Stoughton terminated it. He did not turn in the medical information, so therefore it applied the standard policy.
I have not read the record, but I will. Mr. Rice intimates that he turned in something from the doctor and advised the company that he needed a little more time so the doctor could make an evaluation. Is it your position that that was not good enough for Stoughton?
Stoughton wanted something from the doctor.
Did they get anything from the doctor? Any notes from the doctor? Anything signed that looked like the doctor?
Evaluation for migraines. That's it. And no note for January 24th. And when he came back in, Ms. Dressler said, you have to have a note for January 24th. And there's no note even in the record today as to January 24th.
But is there something for the other days in January or in February?
Yes, well, after 2024.
What about the 27th and 28th?
Yes, there is something in the record.
Okay, there's a note there. That's not good enough, though.
No, it's not.
Why not?
Because it's not.
Could I ask a follow-up question or ask the same question a little bit differently? The commission found as a fact that the incident on January 24th was based on the migraine headaches. Is that right?
Yes.
But your position is that there is no evidence that the employer had that the incident on January 24th was based on that.
There's no documentation, which was required by the policy.
And in fact, the 24th followed a day of vacation.
Yes, the 23rd was a vacation day.
Okay, but there was some documentation of the 28th, 29th, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, correct.
Okay, but that documentation is not good enough because?
It.
Why not?
Because Stoughton wanted and its policy asked for the medical certification form, which provides Stoughton with some insight as to how his absences in the future will be caused by this condition, even if it's a permanent condition.
And his telling you the doctor can't do that because you need another week or whatever it was for medication to see how it turned in is not good enough under Stoughton's rule.
It's not good enough.
Not good enough. And then you don't think that that Stoughton had to make the reasonable accommodation here away from its rule on the form, that was not required here?
Not under these facts, given how long they had been dealing with this issue.
Okay. Good. You have, go ahead, you sum up.
I would just like to sum up on our brief fully addresses on the FMLA issue. We respectfully assert that Stoughton did not violate the FMLA. The Baldwin Love decision is on point.
It's not really before us, is it?
Well,
the Federal Act.
What is before you is that in its second decision, the Labor and Industry Review Commission said you should have exercised clemency and forbearance. And it says we're bound to conclude, because of the Court of Appeals' previous decision, that you violated the FMLA.
Okay.
And so,
it is.
Thank
is there
you.
Anything else you want to say about remedies?
No, they're fully stated in our brief.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank Ms. Brooks, Ms. Lindner, Mr. Carlson, and Mr. Rice for their arguments today on yet another case involving WFMEA. And we appreciate your briefs and your argument. Thank you. That concludes our hearing on 04-AP-1550, Stoughton Trailers, Inc. versus Lurk. We will take a short recess so that these students may leave if they wish, and we are having other students come in for the next case. We're in recess.